We are live from America and just outside the Matrix. It is time for the show that brings you the truth behind the headlines. I'm Lee Stranahan, and this is The Backstory. Okay, another big show today. We got three great guests today. And an update. This could be one of those weeks where we have a guest on twice, because there's big updates on one of our signature stories on this show, the Bill Browder story. So Lucy Commissar will be joining us briefly in the next hour. Then I think we may have her on later in the week as well, because we've got some big Bill Browder news, which is fun to say. There's a lot of alliteration in that, which is also fun to say, because lot and alliteration also work. So if you like alliterating things, those are some, that's a homework assignment for you. Meanwhile, Andrew Arthur will be joining us from the Center for Immigration Studies. We'll be talking about what effect the Biden administration's already announced changes, we'll see what happens, in the immigration policy are going to mean. And Tom Nichols will be joining us with a very interesting story that he just wrote about, and it's sort of historical, but again, I'll save it, but it's interesting. Meanwhile, Engineer Saul is firmly ensconced, and I assume safely ensconced. If you're going to be sconced at all, you might as well be safely, for God's sakes. And of course, our intrepid producer, Rod. Rod, I assume you are in your undisclosed location, correct?
Yeah, that's correct, Lee.
Okay, phew, I was worried. Rod, for a brief second there, it just was hanging a little bit. And I'm like, they may have gotten to Rod. It's possible. And you have a clip that I'm going to prepare you. I'll talk about it a second, but you know more about it than I do. About an athlete being accused of racism for doing his job. Is that a good summary of it, Rod?
Yeah, it's the peak reverse racism that they're trying to put on this young man.
So we'll see. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about that in this break, and we'll play that clip, Saul. Let's get that ready. I assume it is all pre-censored, correct? We're all set on that? Okay. Saul, warn me if it's not. But we'll play that for you. It's a very, very interesting sign of the times. And, of course, we're taking your calls, 202-521-1320. I'm Lee Stranahan, and this is the best damn radio show in the world, The Backstory. Okay, so where do we start? I'll mention a couple of headlines, because there's a couple of big ones. First off, when I woke up this morning, before I even woke up, I tell you, Rod, I got a weird sleep schedule. Hope and I are sometimes up talking at like 3 in the morning, and then we'll go to sleep, and then whatever. But I was up at like 2, 3 in the morning, and news came from the UK, our good friends in the UK, that the first lady, she's like 90, she could be like 92, I forget the exact, close enough. 90, you know, at that point, every day is a miracle. I'll put it like this. If I make it to 65, I will be fairly thrilled. So to me, 90, it's all gravy at that point. But anyway, the first woman was given the Pfizer vaccine in the UK. And this comes after Donald Trump signed an executive order saying, hey, we're going to get the vaccine first. Well, I guess England didn't get the memo on that one. So that's interesting. So I'll just leave that there. President Trump also had a big news conference today on Project Warp Speed, which was their developing this vaccine. And he was very, you know, upbeat, enthusiastically, want to make sure he got the credit for it. Because I don't think he was actually in the lab, his eye to a microscope himself, but he was president. And there was some stuff that had to happen to make the vaccine that a lot of people don't want to take. Because a lot of people don't want to take it. I've actually been following the vax issue for a long time. And because my future ex-wife was not big on vaccination. And I don't want to get into a divorce controversy here, So I will say nice things about my future ex-wife. She was not nutty about it, in my opinion, or I wouldn't have gone along with it. But she had questions. This goes back 20-something years to when we started having kids together. She was really the one having the kids. I had the fun part. And so she was anti-vax for over two decades. I was raised Christian Scientist, which means if you know anything about Christian Science, they don't really do doctors. And I'll just leave it there without getting to the religious thing. But I didn't grow up used to doctors. And so when I say stuff like I'm unqualified to talk about medical stuff, that's literally because I got out of every health class in elementary school. I didn't go to one because my mom would send a note. He's Christian Scientist. And I'd go sit in another room and draw or something. Probably right. I wasn't a good drawer. That's my brother. But my point is, I really don't know this stuff. So my future ex-wife was not big on vaccination. So I've known about it for a while. But I had no idea how many people at this point, 20 years ago, and even recently, it's not the kind of thing you want to say, oh, we didn't vaccinate our kids. And they were homeschooled, so it didn't, whatever. People are like, well, don't your kids have to be vaccinated to go to school? Right. Most of my kids never went to school until the 8 and the 10-year-old this year, mainly because my future ex-wife was trying to establish residency in a place that she had. Well, I see, again, I don't want to be negative, so I'll just be positive. She was deeply concerned about their education all of a sudden. And so our kids have not been in school, so that they didn't have to deal with the vax thing. But it's amazing to me how many people are openly anti-vaccine now in general. And I really don't know what to make of it because, as I say, I didn't go to health class. Now, the other thing that happened, this is big news. General Michael Flynn, who was pardoned the other day by the president, you may recall that, Rod, he was pardoned. Well, apparently being pardoned isn't quite enough because the judge, Emmett Sullivan, who really, really, really wants, you know, if Emmett Sullivan could sort of do that thing they used to do on I Dream of Jeannie, where Jeannie would cross her arms and blink, and then something would happen. If he could blink Michael Flynn into a cell with Julian Assange in Belmarsh Prison, chunk, chunk, blink, boom, he'd be gone. Flynn would be gone. Emmett Sullivan really, 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 really doesn't like Flynn. For some reason. And I can't even, he was talking to an ambassador. I read a whole story in the Washington Post, which, by the way, didn't mention the Justice Department malfeasance like at all, really. But anyway, Sullivan has given in and dismissed the case with prejudice because he really doesn't like him. If Emmett Sullivan could wish Michael Flynn into a cornfield, like on the classic Twilight Zone episode, It's a Wonderful Life, if he could do that, starring the guy who did Fish Heads, if he could do that, a little Barnes and Barnes reference for you there, if he could do that, he would. That's all I'm saying. Okay, now, Rod, I want to make sure we have enough time to get to this. So I don't know. So you're much more of a sports enthusiast than I am, Rod, and I don't say that with any judgment. Thank God you're more of a sports enthusiast than I am, because it brings something like if sports stuff comes up and go, so Rod, how about those whatever Vikings or whoever? I don't know. You're supposed to like the Vikings if you're in South Dakota because we don't have our own football team. So Minneapolis is as close as we get. That's why the Vikings are on my mind because I see their paraphernalia everywhere. And I'm not just talking about their bongs. But Rod, Jake Paul is a fighter and a YouTube celebrity and a white dude, right? So explain this story a little bit and then you can. Rod, this will be exciting for you. You can call for the clip. You just say, Saul, roll that clip, and then you watch. He's pretty good at that. Go ahead, Saul. Rod, what's going on?
Yeah, so, during the Mike Tyson versus Roy Jones fight that happened 2 weekends ago, there was an undercard with a couple fights, and the co-main event was Jake Paul. He has a brother named Logan Paul, and they've transitioned into professional boxing. And Jake Paul, the younger brother, is actually pretty good. He actually knows what he's doing. You can actually see and his videos, training. He's actually a pretty good boxer, and they're millionaires. And he had a fight with a former NBA basketball player named Nate Robinson, and Jake Paul knocked out Nate Robinson. Some people might have seen the viral videos or memes of Nate Robinson knocked out. And fast forward to, I believe it was today or yesterday, Jemele Hill and Kerry Chapman, who's of ESPN, and Jemele Hill used to be of ESPN before she was fired, had Jake Paul on. And Saul, you can roll the audio and we'll hear them accuse him of racism.
Was it racist to knock a black man out? That is the question of the
week. Stop asking me that. I said no.
It's not racist.
It's a question. It's a sport.
Why is it a question? Why is it question?
Because how does this have anything to do with race? It doesn't.
It's a fine question. We got to wake you up. You got to be a part of this conversation.
Okay, now, do you think she's joking there, Rod?
No, she was. That's the most offensive part. She was dead serious. She was asking this, you know, Jake Paul is white and Nate Robinson's black, but that has nothing, you know, race didn't have anything to do with this matter. It was just a agreed competition.
Now, I'm shocked she didn't bring up a noted racist and commie Russian, Ivan Drago, because that guy, he killed Apollo Creed. He didn't just knock him out. So that is just nutty. Are you allowed to dunk on a black man if you're white? Is that in basketball? Would that be considered racist if you dunked on him? I'm not sure. By the way, I'm not sure. You know, some people can't. You're Larry Bird. You're not doing a lot of dunking. Okay. You're a little flat-footed, but okay. But still, pretty good player, Bird. But that is the stupidest freaking thing. If she's serious, that is insane.
She's sitting next to Jemele Hill. She used to be on ESPN. She now writes and speaks for The Hill, and you know we know how The Hill is. And for The Atlantic. And Jemele Hill was fired for saying that Donald Trump is the face of white supremacy, and anybody who votes for him is in support of white supremacy. So I think she was just, you know, she was gassed up to have that type of conversation. And like we're saying, she's serious. And Jake Paul, who's a younger guy, I think he's like 25, 26. He answered it the right way. He just dismissed it. Race has nothing to do with this.
No, it is literally stupid. Now she was in Jemele Hill. She was in, correct me if I'm wrong, she was in Cypress Hill too, correct?
No, I don't think so.
I asked that because she seems actually insane in the membrane. Insane, got no brain. That's what I'm saying. She actually does seem a little, that is, but you know what? Are people going nuts about that? Again, I was not aware of this controversy. This is our sports section of the show. Are people going insane about this as they should be?
Yeah, I just caught it right before we got on air. And that's why I asked to have it on. And people are already online, especially black people. They're offended that she would inject race into this and accuse this man of racism for an agreed competition.
He should have taken a fall. That's what he should have. He should have done, Terry from On the Waterfront, just taking a fall, taking a dive. Bruce Willis in Pulp Fiction, some of the famous divers. Okay, well, there we go. Coming up next, Andrew Arthur will be joining us. We'll be talking about immigration. And is arresting Mexican people racist if they've come over from Mexico? We'll ask all the hard-hitting questions. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is The Backstory. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is The Backstory. In Washington, D.C., you can check us out 105.5 FM, AM 1390. In Kansas City, 102.9, 104.7, and AM 1140. And joining us now from the Center for Immigration Studies is the great Andrew Arthur. Hey, Andrew, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Lee. How are you doing today? I'm all choked up by your warm invitation to have me on. I'm doing great. Thank you.
Well, you know, we always love having you on. And really, one of the reasons I love having you on is just not even as a contrarian. I mean, look, first off, I agree with you guys on the issue. So I'll make that really super clear. I agree with you guys on the issue, but I also don't think there's any fairness in the media on this issue of immigration. It is ridiculous to me how there's only one side that gets presented on this. And it's very bothersome. And I don't think I'm exaggerating too much. You do this for a living, Andrew. Am I wrong, or is there really a like 99-to-1 ratio of stories that present one view about especially illegal immigration, but about the whole immigration issue in general?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely correct, and your point is a good one. I can remember back when I was on Capitol Hill and I would deal with the State Department, I would always ask to speak to the American desk at the State Department so that I could, you know, find somebody who actually cared about the United States. Now, that's an exaggeration. Of course, there are plenty of people, good people at the State Department. That was often said out of frustration. But when you look at the media, when you're dealing with immigration, the fact is it's true. We hear stories about, you know, these horrible things that happen to immigrants. You know, they're arrested while working at a church, or, you know, they're all, you know, frontline medical workers, or they're going to be doctors and computer programmers. But the fact is, there is very little consideration of, one, the effects of illegal migration on the migrants themselves before they come to the United States. And, you know, Doctors Without Borders, of all people, has talked about the horrors that they face. And then, two, there's really no discussion of the effect of a large number of the largely uneducated, unskilled individuals entering the United States, and the effect that that's going to have on the most vulnerable populations in the United States, you know, members of disadvantaged minorities, inner city youth, and those immigrants themselves who are also considered to be Americans under the law. They're not citizens, but considered to be Americans who have, you know, recently come to this country and who have not yet adjusted to life in this country. Everything is, you know, portrayed as if the evil United States government is attempting to, you know, snatch the dreams of a group of people away from them, apparently heedless of the fact that the Immigration and Nationality Act is written by Congress in very restrictive terms. If Congress doesn't like it, they can rewrite it. But until Congress does that, they should enforce it. And respectfully, the media should report it as such, but they just don't.
Yeah, and you know, we've talked about it before. We had Mark Krikorian on from the head of the Center for Immigration Studies recently. And I point this out every time you guys come on because I've looked into it. And if anyone wants to be shocked, go look into it. Go look into the number of groups that are against illegal immigration very explicitly. You'll find Center for Immigration Studies is really the only think tank who's doing it. There's a few other groups that'll bring it up peripherally. Then go look at who's in favor of illegal immigration. Go look it up and get back to me in a couple days, because there are literally dozens and dozens, and if we go nationwide, hundreds of groups and tens of thousands of people. And I really don't think that's an exaggeration, because I've looked into it. When you add up the employees, the board members, the infrastructure, I think it's thousands and thousands of people who are promoting this other agenda. And they do it through the media, through white papers, through a zillion ways, fun things, you know, events where kids draw butterflies, or, you know what I'm saying, Andrew, that kind of thing. And it's everywhere. I don't understand. Literally, it's so bizarre, because you would think enforcing laws that are on the books wouldn't be that controversial, yet it's extremely controversial by the numbers. And there's a whole industry, and I don't know how else to call it. There's a whole industry pushing this narrative. And again, if I'm exaggerating, feel free to shut me down on this, Andrew.
No, absolutely not. And you look at the way that, President Trump's immigration policies have been implemented. I think last year they deported ICE deported about 85,000 people. That's out of a population estimated by Pew Research Council of about 10.7 million. So that's 85,000 versus 10.7 million. Unless you think that that is some, you know, awful, horrendous number, consider the fact that in the early years, I think throughout the Obama administration, they deported 5 million plus people. So, you know, it really is odd. I think people conflate the president's rhetoric with the facts on the ground. And, you know, the president has plainly done what he could with respect to immigration. There are things that he could have done that he didn't. But, you know, immigration enforcement today is actually much less than it was 5 years ago and significantly less than when I was a trial attorney in San Francisco back in the 1990s. So, you know, I'm always just a little shocked when I read these things. And if, you know, Google the word, you know, Trump immigration cruel or Trump immigration heartless or, you know, kids in cages, which, by the way, is one of the biggest canards. And, you know, part of the reason why I like doing your show, Lee, is because it's an expanded format. So if I could just get into that for a second. The facilities that were built along the border to process migrants who were apprehended entering illegally were built back in the 1980s and 1990s. Many of those buildings look exactly the same way as they did the first time that I ever went there, you know, when I was young to the field. Those were buildings that were built to process single adult males, almost exclusively from Mexico. They'd be held for about 8 hours. Today, you know, we've started to, you know, swing back to that model, but certainly throughout 2019 into 2020, although it's starting on the upturn again, the vast majority of migrants were family units. You know, that's adults with children. Those facilities were never built to process those individuals, and most of them are from countries other than Mexico, which meant that the processing time was about 48 hours. And so, you know, you're now holding people for six times as long, you have to, in order to process them, in facilities that were never built to process them to begin with. That's why in the second presidential debate, which people call the third one, although the second one never happened, there was a, you know, big discussion about kids in cages. Those are barriers that were erected in those facilities in order to protect young migrants, you know, young female migrants from older, unrelated adult males, primarily young male migrants as well. It was never, you know, intended to, you know, be some sort of punitive measure. Back in 2019, beginning in May 1, President Trump, you know, begged for money from Congress in order to ameliorate the situation. But rather than taking care of it, Congress did nothing but head to the border, get a lot of photo ops of them, you know, staring at what was going on as if they were, you know, observers in a zoo or something like that, which in my mind is reprehensible, and never got around to appropriating the money that the president wanted for almost 7 weeks. And even then, it wasn't enough. So, you know, this is one of those canards that the press exists to address, to respond to, but instead they just continue it, and it makes no sense. I was, honestly, Lee, I was the lone voice that I can think of who was attempting to explain, you know, how the situation occurred, you know, what was going on, and how it could be addressed. I even testified before Congress on this, and, you know, it still, we're stuck with the same 1980s, 1990s facilities that we had 30, 40 years ago. So until Congress gets around to actually appropriating money, the next time there's a wave, and I can almost guarantee you that under President-elect presumptive Joe Biden, there will be another wave of people coming to the border, we're going to see those same pictures. Now, whether the press reports on those pictures as fulsomely as they have under the Trump administration is a different issue, but you know, the fact is the same problems exist because the same structural problems in the law and in physical plan along the border exist.
Again, you know, when I started to look in this issue as a journalist a few years ago, I really came into it with an open mind, I don't know how else to put it. Like, okay, well, maybe I'm sure there could be some stuff going on. And it was so stunning to me how one-sided all of the reporting is and how easy it is to burst it like a bubble. And people forget, I'll call it basic human nature. If if you were to say, for instance, we're not going to enforce when you go buy booze, if you look young, it's going to be, we're not going to ask for ID. We're going to make that, we're going to frown upon that. But what happened is lots of people who are under the age of 21 would go buy booze. Now, I can say that prediction, it's completely theoretical, but I'll say it with some degree of certainty. If that happened, a lot. Now, by the way, here's the way it would happen. The first day, you wouldn't see a huge influx of 18-year-olds or 16-year-olds going to buy booze because they think, well, this sounds too good to be true. That can't be the case. That's not possible. Then some brave 16-year-old would venture into a liquor store and walk out with a bottle of Jack. And he would go back to his friends and go, well, guess what? They didn't ask me for an ID. And then everyone would still be a little afraid. And then the next day or so, another brave soul or two would walk in and then go, wait a minute, it worked. And then you would see a flood. And that's what we've seen over and over again with a lot of issues. But on immigration, for instance, the idea that you could go to the border and if you said, I am in fear for my life because I'm being oppressed in my country by political, whatever the statement is. And then they'll say, okay, well, just go right in after you. You know, you have to, if you're hearing about this, please show up for it. At first, I think a lot of people didn't believe it because, right, because it sounds too good to be true and it sounds like a scam. But then what happens is word gets back. And isn't that the pattern over and over again where at first some of these things sound like, well, wait, what? I can really get away with that? And then everyone figures out, yeah, they can. And so then the flood starts. Is that a useful theory of human behavior here?
That is a spot on explanation. But in reality, Lee, the problem is even worse than the one that you've described. In your scenario, you know, teenagers end up getting their hands on alcohol, which, as you and I know, happens in the United States every day of the week in every state in the union. But in this particular situation, this becomes part of the business model of the smugglers themselves. And again, you know, I could go on and on about how awful smugglers are, but about 2/3 of all migrants who make their way to the United States are physically assaulted, and a significant number of female migrants are sexually assaulted. I think the number is about 1/3 of them. So the smugglers actually use the lax enforcement of the immigration laws as part of their business model in order to draw people from villages in, you know, Quetzaltenango, Guatemala, or San Pedro Sula, Honduras, or anywhere else that you can think of, San Salvador, and say, look, all you got to do is do this. You could come to the United States, and you could be making $10 an hour, $15 an hour working in a pizzeria instead of an eighth of that you will make working an entire day in, you know, your hometown. So pay me $7,000 and you're going to be able to make, you know, hundreds of times that amount of money once you get to the United States. What they never tell you is how dangerous that journey is, how bad of human beings they are, the sorts of people that they have to deal with. Now, it's important to note when we talk about smugglers, you know, people conflate them with the cartels and God knows what. Smugglers are generally, you know, independent contractors or part of a loose confederation, a chain of people who lead folks to the United States. So they're not the cartels. But, and here's the bad part, they pay money to the cartels in order to cross what they deem their territory. And I put that in air quotes. So, you know, generally for every migrant that makes it to the United States, Sinaloa, Los Zetas, the Gulf Cartel, the CJNG, you know, all of the people who are leading to the ungodly death rates in Mexico are making money. And that money gets plowed right back into their business so that they can peddle more drugs in the United States because we are the destination country for the drugs that are created abroad. So it becomes a vicious circle of smuggler goes to the village, talks somebody into coming. They come to the United States. They never mention the horrible part. They mention the fact that they're here and they're living in, you know, Fort Lee, New Jersey, or, you know, Pomona or wherever. And, you know, that just encourages their friends and neighbors and family to come and move to the United States, too. So our non-enforcement of the laws becomes part of their business model. And their business model, Lee, is god-awful. It's like, you know, me going to, you know, a horrible neighborhood in Washington, D.C., although I think the average home price in D.C. now is $1 million. So it's tough to find a bad neighborhood. But, you know, going to any, you know, going to inner city Baltimore or, you know, South Philly and just grabbing a random person on the street corner, giving them your 8-year-old child and telling them that, you know, you want that child to make it his or her way to San Francisco, California. That's really the most apt analogy. And respectfully, there's, you know, that is a direct cognate to what's happening right now. If only the press would report on that part of the story. But the press only ever reports on the part of the story once the guy in the green uniform with the white van shows up at the border and takes them into custody, and the little girl wearing the pink sweater who stares up and tears in her eyes as her mother is being questioned by the Border Patrol agent. It does a disservice to the American people. It speaks down to the American people. But here's the funny thing, Lee. Yes, I mean, we are, you know, Vox Clamante and Deserto, we are the voice crying out in the desert at the Center for Immigration Studies. But the American people aren't fooled. The media is fooled. Big industry is fooled. Big tech is fooled. But the American people somehow managed to understand that out-of-control border is not only bad for the United States, but it's bad for the people who come here, regardless of what the press tells them.
Absolutely. And so when I was up in Twin Falls, Idaho, a few years ago, covering a story up there, I learned a lot about the dairy industry in Idaho. And somebody took me for a ride out in the country, in beautiful, beautiful country. And that's dairy country there. There's a lot of Basque, actually, in Twin Falls, Idaho, because climate-wise, the region is similar to the Basque region. So that was an interesting thing I learned up there. But they took me out to one of the big dairy farms, and they showed me the living conditions that the illegal migrant workers were living in. And so you got to picture a manure pile, and it's about the size of 3 semi-wide trailers, right? About that big. It's a huge pile of manure. Then about 60 feet from that pile of manure, and I took footage with it with my drone, is the housing. And by the way, it didn't smell great. I don't know if I'm painting that part of the picture. That's where the housing is for the people who work on the dairy farm. And what had happened was they had started to complain about it because they realized that they weren't going to get deported. And then what they did was they fired them and replaced them with African workers they'd brought over under the refugee program. So they basically were replacing one group of people. It was largely Hispanic dairy workers, who, as you're pointing out, were earning a better living than they could earn at their home, which is another story. Like, let's solve that problem. But no. But then they get fired for complaining about working conditions and replaced by another group who, by the way, once they start complaining, will doubtlessly be replaced by another group. So there's this endless cycle. And this is why groups like the Chamber of Commerce are so pro-illegal immigration, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, I, in one of my pieces, you know, I quoted extensively from, you know, Karl Marx and Das Kapital, not a guy that I read every day of the week. But, you know, he's described that situation exactly, described it in the middle of the 19th century in the United Kingdom, you know, where you have this limitless labor population that is, you know, becomes susceptible to exploitation because there are so many. And if, you know, they complain or, you know, there's a problem or there's a cheaper worker you can hire, they're out the door and somebody else is in. That is exactly what the immigration laws of the United States since 1885. I mean, this isn't, you know, some Donald Trump idea in 2017. This is 135 years of immigration laws has been meant to prevent that, you know, individuals who come to the United States, and let's face it, Lee, I mean, and this is important for the American people to know, you know, we accept more people for permanent resettlement in this country than any other country on the face of the earth, probably more than the rest of the world combined every year. So it's not like, you know, we're closing the door, you know, that Donald Trump closed the door on people coming to the United States. We have very, very, favorable and humanitarian immigration laws. But even then, there are violations of those immigration laws with seeming impunity, as if immigration laws don't exist. And anytime you ever bring this up, you always hear the same thing. You'll hear the same two things. Either you'll hear some quote from the New Colossus by Emma Lazarus, which was attached to the Statue of Liberty, you know, a couple decades after it was put up, or alternatively, you'll hear we're a nation of immigrants, and we are, and we should be, and, you know, immigration is a good thing. But, you know, the laws have to be enforced, and here's, you know, really what brings all this full circle, and the part that, you know, people who claim they are, you know, all about immigration and love immigration miss. When the American people see that immigration no longer, you know, is intended to promote the interests of the American people, they're going to lose heart in immigration. Nothing is guaranteed in this country. You know, remember what Ronald Reagan said, freedom's not in our DNA. It has to be taught generation to generation. And the same is true of immigration. You know, we've seen swings throughout U.S. history where the American people turn against immigration, but they don't do that because they're haters. They don't do that because they're, you know, whatever, you know, epithet you want to hurl at them. They do it because they've lost faith in immigration. We need to make sure that the American people never lose faith in immigration, never lose faith in asylum, never lose faith in our refugee process. We are the mother of immigrants. We are, and here we go, I'm going to quote the New Colossus. You know, we are the lady with the light. And, you know, we want people to come to this country because they come here with new ideas and, you know, fresh energy, fresh blood in, you know, the metaphorical sense of the term. And, you know, we see this, but that doesn't mean that, you know, we can just ignore the laws. That doesn't mean that we, you know, let everybody in, because if we do, the people who get hurt the most are the ones who are at the edges of our society, not the people who are getting their lawns cut and their hedges trimmed and their manure, pitchforked. It's the people who don't have the benefit of a good education. You know, I give credit to my parents for, you know, literally impoverishing themselves. I came from a lower middle class family, and my parents poured everything that they had into my education, the education of my siblings, so that, you know, I could have the best chance. But there are a lot of kids in the inner city, and I'm from Baltimore. I, you know this from personal experience, who just haven't had the advantages that I've had, that I've been able to give to my son. And we need to look out for those Americans too. We especially need to look out for those Americans. And yet that gets completely lost in this debate. A few years ago, I did a program for a major newspaper. They had a webcast that they did. And, you know, I discussed these ideas, and the host looked at me as if I had three heads. You know, we're talking about immigration. Why are you talking about poor kids in the inner city? As if the two things can ever be, untangled. We need to protect vulnerable Americans. Rich people are going to make it on their own. Tech titans are, you know, they'll be eating Chateaubriand when we're cooking rats over garbage can fires. But, you know, it's those people who are at the margins that the immigration laws are supposed to protect. But you know what they don't have, Lee? They don't have a special interest group. They don't have a PAC. They don't have a website where they can, you know, talk about their problems. They're the forgotten Americans, but they're the Americans that are supposed to be protected by our immigration laws, as are new Americans. And yet, you know, their views don't count because, quite frankly, you know, people want, strawberries for, $3 a pound rather than $3.16 a pound or whatever. And it makes no sense, and it does a disservice. And that's why there's so many people on the other side, because the other side is so well-financed because they want that machine of, hidden misery to continue. They don't want the misery to continue. I really think they're, people of good faith. But, they don't think at all about the consequences downstream of what they're doing.
Well, let's talk. We got to go to a short break here, Andrew. But when we come back, let's talk about the other side of this. And it relates to a new bill that's been put forward by people like Mike Lee. Republicans are putting it forward. It's not just the bed makers and the lettuce pickers. That's not why the biggest funders of pro anti-immigration stuff are high tech companies. They don't. It's not that they just want their hotel beds made up. It's about tech workers as well. Let's talk about that, the H-1B visa program, and other topics related to immigration that you're really not going to hear anywhere else. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is The Backstory. We are back. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is The Backstory, joined now by Andrew Arthur from the Center for Immigration Studies. Where can people find, do you know the website address off the top of your head, Andrew?
We do. It's cis.org. And if you want to look for my work in particular, it's /Arthur. But I highly commend the work of all of my fellows at the Center for Immigration Studies.
Yeah, as do I. You guys really do. Again, I started talking to Mark back. I'll tell you, back when I was in Idaho, so that would have been 2000, maybe 15, 16, something like that. And maybe it was even a little before that, because I was aware of the issue before. And one of the things I was aware of, it was before that, because I really got into immigration in one of my hiatuses from Breitbart there, where I started looking to this H-1B program. And I found it very organically, because I was looking into, I was following the money, as journalists are told to do. And when you look at the money for immigration, I looked at who was funding this. And to my surprise, it wasn't the Hotel and Motel Association or the, the lettuce farmers. It was high tech companies. It was Apple. It was Google. It was Facebook in particular. And it was bizarre to me, because I'm like, well, wait a second. Why are high tech companies? And that got me onto the H-1B program that I did a number of pieces about. This probably was 2013 or 2014 even. And I started to really look into it. And I was very disturbed by the H-1B program in particular, because I felt it really penalized. First off, I don't believe the argument about there's jobs Americans don't want to do. I did those jobs. I worked at restaurants when I was 18, 19, 20 years old, and it was great. I think restaurant work is fantastic, and I think it's a great way to get into the workforce. You learn to read a schedule, to show up sober, to do your job, and to develop a work ethic. And that's really gone for a lot of kids now. They're not even possibly going to do it. But then I looked into the high-tech aspect. And it's something I know a bit about how they were hiring high tech workers and people who played by the rules. They'd gone to college. They'd gotten a STEM degree, were suddenly training people who'd been brought in from India or China to largely India, but China and a few other countries as well, to replace them. And it was so disturbing to me. Now, what's this new bill that Mike Lee is and other Republicans are pushing, and how does it relate to the H-1B program?
Yeah, this is H.R. 1044, the Fairness for High-Skilled Immigrants Act, and basically what it does is it lifts certain per-country caps on individuals who are coming to the United States as, high-skilled immigrants. And let me just give you an example. under that bill, if it passes as written, it's gone to conference, citizens of India and to a lesser extent China would be guaranteed 85% of all employment-based green cards in the first year after passage and 90% in the next 2 years. Now, most of those people are coming to the United States in order to take STEM jobs, to work in the STEM field, you know, primarily, you know, high-tech, computer-oriented positions. What it would do is it would alleviate the per-country caps that have existed for years on employment-based visas and allow them to come to the United States more quickly. Right now, about 20 to 25% of all employment-based green cards per annum go to citizens of India, and most of those people are coming here to, you know, take those tech jobs. And one of the things that you'll always see, you know, you watch commercials and, you know, you'll see about, you know, how we need STEM workers. You know, we need to, you know, make sure that our kids get a good STEM education. Census Bureau a few years ago did a report that showed that about 25% of all people who had STEM-related degrees were actually working in a STEM-related field. So we actually graduate many more people in the STEM field then go to work in those fields. And again, you know, going back to what we were talking about, minority groups, blacks, Hispanics, and women, now that women are not a minority, but are, you know, actually underrepresented in high-tech fields. And yet at the same time, you know, we are bringing in people from abroad to do those jobs. And these are good-paying jobs. I wrote about a suit that has been filed by the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division against Facebook that just came down will be litigated. And again, all of this is alleged. But the allegation was that Facebook was holding jobs for people who were here on temporary visas, on H-1Bs, so that they could, Facebook could petition for them to get specific jobs that paid on average $156,000 a year. Let me underscore again, this is a complaint that was only recently filed. None of this has been proven, and it'll probably take years before this case reaches a resolution. But it gives you, you know, some sort of idea into the types of jobs that we're talking about. I mean, $156,000. You talked about my first job out of college, I got paid $13,500 a year. If there were any job that would have paid me $25,000 a year, I would have been thrilled. If I had a job that could pay $100,000 a year, I would assume that I had won the lottery. So, you know, it is an unusual situation where, you know, our schools are turning out graduates in these fields. You know, plainly they are, you know, certain ethnic groups are, you know, underrepresented in these fields. We need to do a better job of that. But it doesn't really matter because, you know, once they get out, are those jobs going to be available to them or are those jobs going to be taken by somebody who's coming from abroad? And all too often, the answer is those jobs are going to be taken by somebody who's coming from abroad under the guise of there are no Americans who can take that job at the going rate, or they have, you know, they're aliens of such extraordinary ability that we have to have this specific person and no American can possibly meet the qualifications.
And of course, that's absurd. And we know it's absurd because in some cases they're replacing workers who did have the job. But once again, like we were talking about how this ultimately is also unfair to the immigrants, part of the thing about this H-1B visa program, correct me if I'm wrong in this, that let's say you're brought over from India and you think, great, okay, I'm moving to America, I'll be able to earn this money and it'll be good and I can bring my family over eventually, and so on and so forth. So then you get over there, and maybe you find that they're working you incredibly long hours, or they've given you a computer at your apartment so they can call on you day or night if they need you to write something. And then you say to yourself, oh, okay, this isn't too great. And then you look down the road, you're talking to people at lunch, and they go, well, hey, you know what? I'm working over at this other company, or we got a new startup going. and you seem skilled. You can't quit the job you were brought over to do, is my understanding. In other words, if my company and my company is probably Facebook or Google, it's not probably Lee's, you know, software company. It's probably a big conglomerate, right? If I bring you over to do that job, you can't leave. And if you do, if you say, you know what, I'm going to quit to go down the street to work for a startup, you have to go back to your country. You lose your ability to stay there. And so I, as an employer, have an ability to control you as an employee that I could not do with an American. Is that correct, Andrew?
Everything that you've just said is correct. And that really is, you know, one of the biggest issues with, you know, the temporary non-immigrant worker visa is that, you know, you are tied to the job. Now, again, you know, whether abuses occur, I can't tell you, you know, specifically, but is that an area in which an individual could be subject to abuse? Absolutely. And, you know, that's the problem. You know, keep in mind, the great thing about the United States is, you know, if you can go anywhere that you have the skills and ability to find a job. But when you talk about a class of individuals who don't have that ability, and that's one of the assertions that DOJ mentioned in its press release in the Facebook case, yeah, that's a problem. And, you know, you're basically tied to that job until they get you a permanent visa. That can take years to happen. So, you know, it is, it's a problem. And, you know, is it an area that is ripe for abuse? Absolutely. Ripe for abuse, not ripe with abuse. But is it ripe with abuse? It wouldn't surprise me if it is, just because of how easily abused the system could be.
Well, and all people need to do is look up Velvet Sweatshop. That's a little term. Put that in quotes in your search engine. And you'll find that that's exactly what was going on in some of these places. Or they'd bring someone over and they'd say, okay, you're going to do this IT job, let's say. And then they basically double or triple them up on the workload. And they say basically, well, now you're going to do this IT job and this other IT job. So they're able to fire two other workers to keep that one. So it's one of those things, because these are good jobs. And a lot of people, you know, look, I've worked in restaurants. I don't particularly want to work in one, although it's kind of fun. But I don't want to pick lettuce, right? I don't want to. I never wanted to. That's why I've never done it. That's why I don't garden. But I don't want to pick lettuce. And a lot of people empathize with that. They go, yeah, I wouldn't. That seems like tough work. I wouldn't want to do that. But when you hear computer programmer, most people go, well, you know what? Or IT person, you go, you know what? You're in an air-conditioned room. It seems nice. Like you say, the money's good. It's $154K a year. Radio hosts don't. I'll just say this. Radio hosts I know don't make that, right? And some of them I know very intimately because they're me. I'm just saying that that's a good amount of money, and I get paid, I think, very fairly for what I do. But that's more money than I'm making. That's the only point I want to make there. So people go, okay, well, I can picture myself doing that job, but they never hear about this, and all anyone has to do. Again, I'm right. The funding for the pro-illegal immigration movement comes from these big tech companies, doesn't it?
That's why when you know, look behind, you know, who is, you know, sponsoring, who exactly provides the money to these organizations, you know, big tech, you know, big business, you know, pops up all the time. Because, you know, again, I'm a capitalist, and I believe that you should be able to, you know, spend your money as you want. And if you want to spend that money, you know, lobbying or, you know, opening up your own think tank that'll produce your own research, that's absolutely fine. But it would be better if the press in this country, you know, accurately reported on these things rather than just, you know, the occasional really bad situation that pops out. You know, if you don't read my blog, if you don't, you know, go looking for the Department of Justice website to see what their media releases are, you probably never would have known about that Facebook case. You would never know the allegations that they make therein. Again, are they true? Aren't they? I have no idea. That's for a court of law, and it'll be determined eventually. But just the fact that there are allegations like that ought to be enough to make members of the press, you know, go looking to see what happens. That's part of something called the Protecting U.S. Workers Initiative, and it's important to understand what that is. That's an initiative that came out of an executive order that was issued by President Trump in 2017 by American Hire American. And that was to really make sure that, you know, if there are good jobs out there, that people are being brought into this country to work, that they go to Americans first. And, you know, the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department, which is not exactly the most right-wing organization you're ever going to find, has actually had a number of successful prosecutions. They've got about $1.2 million in back wages and fines out of employers. Facebook will be the largest one.
Hey, Andrew, we're out of time. Thanks so much for joining us. Always a great deep dive with you on the subject of immigration. More coming up. Next hour, I'm Lee Stranahan. This is The Backstory. Back. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is the show that brings you the truth behind the headlines, the backstory. Thanks so much to Andrew Arthur for joining us in the last hour. Coming up this hour, Lucy Commissar. Also, we're going to have the great Tom Nichols joining us with a very interesting story. We're going to have Lucy on for an update about the Bill Browder story, one of our signature stories, and of course, we're taking your calls, 202-521-1320. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is The Backstory. So always a great segment with Andrew Arthur, and I really do like highlighting people from Center for Immigration Studies because I swear to God, Rod, they are one of the only groups out there working on these issues. And here's the thing about it. I really do believe, I was going to say this to Andrew, even with 45 minutes, we ran out of time with him. But I was going to mention this to him, Rod. There's a left-wing argument to be made for against illegal immigration. In fact, the left used to make this argument all the time. Do you know what that argument is?
No, I could imagine that it disenfranchises Black Americans the most, but maybe you have something different.
You're very close. This is why Cesar Chavez was part of an operation that the FBI did called Operation Wetback. Now, I'm not making that. That was the name that they gave it. And Chavez was in favor of it. Cesar Chavez, the famed union organizer who worked with people like Dolores Huerta, who I've interviewed, Dolores Huerta and Chavez, back in the 60s, were basically huge people in the labor movement. By the way, Chavez was also associated with cults and cult leaders, but that's a story for another day. I wrote a big piece about that over at Breitbart. There was a very good, I was very proud of that piece because it was very deeply researched and every link you can see, it's true. But Chavez was absolutely opposed to illegal immigrant Mexican labor because he was working on the people who were here and trying to get them better wages. So the argument from the left is, one of them is, you cannot have a country with the benefits that people on the left, and I'm not even talking the far left here, although you could be, people on the far left, they often oppose illegal immigration too. But it doesn't make any difference. People on the mainstream left to the far left, and the progressive left, the people who want, for instance, Medicare for all now, how are you going to fund a system of Medicare for all when you have unlimited, unfettered illegal immigration? People already, the big question about Medicare for all is how are you going to pay for it? Well, how are you going to pay for it when everybody involved, you know, there's a greater and greater number of people coming into the country? You can't. And so there is a left-wing argument that, you know, again, I'm on the right, so I agree with Andrew when he talks about being a capitalist. And this is a populist issue. I really believe that. This is an issue that if you present it properly, you get about 80% of the people. I'll put it like this. A lot of these issues, the whole trick behind them, immigration is one. The defund the police movement right now is another one. A lot of stuff with, I'll see myself on defund the police and raise myself a Black Lives Matter. I was playing poker with my 8-year-old over the weekend, by the way, Rod. That's why I got poker in the brain. It was his idea. I did a card trick for him. It kind of amazed him. By the way, doing card tricks for an 8-year-old, not the trickiest thing, but okay. Then he wanted to play poker, so I got poker on the brain. Black Lives Matter, if you present it honestly, which is, if you were to take a poll and ask people, are you in favor of a revolutionary communist movement founded by three revolutionary communists with connections to the 60s Weather Underground group, continuing the work of the Black Panthers, which, you know, some people like the Black Panthers, but okay, they don't understand them. So let's skip that for now. But just as you said, does that seem like a good idea? And one of their goals is to get rid of police entirely. They don't just want to defund them. They want to get rid of police. Oh, by the way, they also want to let everybody out of prison. I think that's, how do you think that's going to poll with people, Rod? If you laid it out the way I just did, and you ask the average person, does releasing everyone from prison seem like a good idea? How many people do you think are actually going to sign up for that one?
Well, anybody who would sign up for that, you know, they must have a suicide pact that we don't know about. You know, I definitely agree with you. And then I've made the, you know, as far as the immigration thing, I've made the offering, or, you know, hypothetical offering, that to the left wing, if that, you know what, you get your Medicare for all if there's a 10-year moratorium on immigration. And it kind of leaves them kind of perplexed and thinking about if they really want their Medicare for all. Are they willing to give up, you know, letting in unfettered amount of people?
Now, so since you're bringing this up, let me talk about insurance for a second, because it's also on my mind. And the reason it's on my mind is December 15th is coming up, and I need to enroll, because that's when the open enrollment period ends, in insurance. Since I moved up to South Dakota, for reasons I won't get into because they're boring to even me, I have to get my own insurance at this point, because it's a long story, but basically, because I moved, the coverage that we had doesn't cover where I am. So I have to get my own coverage. And so I have to, so I can't go through the company as I've done for the past few years. So the open enrollment period is going on. And so I went to, first off, you know, I went to healthcare.gov, which is where you're supposed to go, I guess. And man, our insurance system does suck. I will just say this. It really does suck. The open enrollment period, and I'll get back to, I was complaining a little bit about human nature. And if you look at the title of the show today, perhaps that's what I'm doing. But I was saying this earlier about when I brought up the liquor store analogy, which is if people figure out that you're not checking IDs, you're going to get a lot of drunk 15-year-olds. And I'll say this with our insurance industry. A lot of it's based, and I understand it, on human nature, which is this. I realize why you have an open enrollment period. Because if you didn't, people would wait until the last minute. Like when they get sick, they'd go, well, you know, they'd start coughing or something. And they go, wait a minute, I think there's something wrong with me. I better get insurance now before I call the doctor. And that's when people would do it, at the absolute last minute. Now, I've said this before about one of the reasons I liked Barack Obama in 2007 and 2008 when I was a Democrat, as opposed to Hillary Clinton, is that he was opposed to the individual mandate of forcing people to, you know, basically Hillary Clinton was in favor of the individual mandate, which Obama switched on. But the individual mandate forces you to do it. I will be honest. I would rather just see it be a tax. If I had a choice between a tax increase and some individual mandate, our insurance system is screwed up. As I said, part of it is because if you just leave it so that people, well, we assume people will be honest and they're just going to buy insurance. No, they're not going to do that, particularly if you're young or whatever. You're not going to buy insurance if you don't have to. And so then what happens is you get people free riding on the system, right? They don't buy insurance until the last second. And again, I would completely be okay. Me too. That's what I do because I'm not stupid. I had a friend of mine. I mentioned the cameras I use here is from NewTek, the company I used to work for. And NewTek, I've mentioned this before. This story is going someplace. It'll wind right back around. Don't you worry. I'm a professional. But NewTek, the president of NewTek for a long time, he's left the company now, is the guy who started the company, Tim Jennison. Tim is the subject, by the way, of a film directed by Teller from Penn and Teller because he was friends with Penn and Teller. And it's called Tim's Vermeer. And if you want to get a sense of who Tim is, that's a good film to watch. Tim's Vermeer. He figured out a way to, he's not an artist. He's a brilliant musician, though, by the way. He figured out a way to paint a Vermeer without being able to paint. And it's this big machine he kind of invented, but he thinks Vermeer could have used it. So anyway, that's who Tim is. So I was talking to Tim 30 years ago when I was working at NewTek. And Tim, arch capitalist, we met. Part of the reason he hired me is when I went to his office, he had a picture of Ayn Rand on his wall. So I'm like, okay, I was at Ayn Rand's funeral. He's like, really? And then that helped get me hired. So Tim, arch capitalist. And Tim told me once that he used to have hair down to his butt and he lived on a commune. And if you know Tim, arch capitalist, you'd go, wait, what? Why were you living on a commune? He said, well, you know, I was 19 or whatever. And he said, and he's a musician. And he said, this is before I was a capitalist. He said, I lived on a commune. He said, there were two kinds of people who lived in the commune. There were the ones who did their part and worked hard. And then they were the lazy ones. And he said, I was smart. I was one of the lazy ones. And that's how we bring it back. That's human nature, right? If there's no benefit to you working harder, maybe you'll work harder, maybe for the, you know, for pride or self-esteem or whatever you tell yourself when you're laying there in bed at night going, man, I'm sore. And that bastard in the top bunk, he didn't do anything today. And yet, you know, he was doing bong hits up in the, he didn't get out of the bunk. And I'm out there hoeing soybeans or something, whatever you do on a collective farm. I don't know. I've never worked on one. But that's human nature. Human nature is you'll eventually figure out that the ones who are lazy are smart, actually. There's no reason for you to work harder. So our insurance system, something's got to be done about it because the whole system is screwy. And I might sort of kind of be in favor of the idea that parts of the system, no one's ever given me a good argument against this, that parts of the system need to be just built in. And it's not that I think you've got a right to health care, because I don't. But I also don't think you have a right to roads, but every government that's ever existed on earth builds them. This goes back to the Romans. Via est lata, that's all I remember from my Latin class. It means the road is wide. I might not even be saying it right, but who cares? No one speaks Latin. It didn't work out well for them. But the point is, our healthcare system makes no frickin' sense whatsoever. It is the worst of every system, basically. It's got elements of bureaucracy like you get in any single-payer healthcare system. Yeah, sure, we got that. And I've said it before, and I'll say it again. The worst part of the system is that when you the company you pay. Like I had this in California. I paid Kaiser. They were my insurance company and my hospital. That makes no freaking sense. So we should, I would love to find somebody sane on this subject, Rod. Let's look for that. Coming up next, Lucy Commerce will be joining us. We've got an update on the Bill Browder story that you're not going to want to miss. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is The Backstory. We are back. I'm Lee Stranahan, and this is The Backstory. Before we get to the great Lucy Commissar, who will be joining us to talk about an update on the Bill Browder story, I have some breaking news for you. And if you're a Trump supporter, prepare to have your heart broken. Although if you've been listening to this show, hopefully I've been stealing you from the blow. But the Supreme Court, in a no dissent, one line ruling, said they're not going to hear the case about Pennsylvania. So anybody who has been saying, as they're desperately clinging by their fingernails onto the cliff and hoping now they got one finger in the fingernail, the Supreme Court, this wasn't close. One line ruling, no dissent. We're not going to hear the Pennsylvania case. So if Pennsylvania is certified, I think that's it. I mean, it's over. But now the fact that you're not even going to have, you don't even get the drama, well, maybe the Supreme Court will say no. So there we go. Again, I've been telling you, this seems over for a long time to me. And I guarantee you, I could have made a lot more money if I just lied to people and said stuff like stop the steal or whatever. But now, if you're a Trump supporter, stop the squeal. Stop it. Stop it. Okay, now. Back to join us once again, Lucy Commissar. Someone saying reporting fake news, go look it up. Someone saying the chat room is fake news. That's what the Supreme Court ruled. So go figure it out. There we go. Lucy Commissar is joining us because we got an update and we may get Lucy back on midweek. Hey, Lucy, how you doing?
Okay, I'm glad to talk to you again. Now, there's a lot of news that comes out of this Bill Browder story.
There is. So as I understand it, and we talked with you about this when you were on last week. The EU was trying to pass their own sanctions bill. We'll talk about that in a second. And Bill Browder wanted to name it the Magnitsky Human Rights Bill or whatever. And the Dutch apparently said, we don't want to do that. And they passed it. And they didn't put the Magnitsky Act on it. So they didn't put Magnitsky's name on it, which seems like a big loss for Bill Browder. But so how am I doing on summarizing that part of the story? What am I missing?
Yes, no, this is correct. So it was yesterday, December 7th, which remember the day that will live in infamy, this may be one. They passed a sanctions act, and it's aimed, they say, at the world's human rights abusers. So what does it do? It bans visas and freezes assets of people it says are guilty of crimes against humanity, slavery, extrajudicial killings, enforced disappearances, arbitrary arrests, human trafficking, sexual violence. You know, this is a very long list. And anyone who makes profit from any of this. And there was a talk of who might be targeted. The Russians, of course, no mention of China. Certainly not of Julian Assange or the torture centers of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. So you understand that this is West European with probably American involvement, political operation. And the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen keeps calling it the European Magnitsky Act, but William Browder lost because the ministers refused to name the law after his former tax evasion accountant, Sergei Magnitsky. And this is important because these laws, there are five, the US, UK, and three Balkan states. They are the Browder Protection Acts because the purpose is to build political walls against the Russians for calling him to account for $100 million in tax evasion, illicit buys of Gazprom shares. So this is the importance of what happened. It's just another a human rights act which will be targeted at their enemies, not at any of them or their allies. But for the importance, interesting, they would not put the Magnitsky name on it. And almost funny, the EU has a new chief of foreign affairs and security policy. His name is Josep Borrell, and he told reporters in Brussels, we are launching this global sanctions regime. It'll be the equivalent of the Magnitsky Act of the United States. But a week before that, he said at the European Parliament Foreign Affairs Committee, he never heard of Magnitsky or legislation named after him. He apparently hasn't heard of Julian Assange afterwards. So he was taking his orders, and that shows you something about the people that were passing this legislation. They were taking orders. By the way, he was a Spanish foreign minister, and he said, and he was born in Catalonia, but he opposes independence. And I wonder if the jailing of the Catalonian political leaders will put Spain on the sanctions list. If you think I'm suggesting any hypocrisy here, you would be right.
Well, here's what I noticed about Lucy, because I looked it up today. The first thing I did, of course, was I went over to Bill Browder's Twitter feed to see if he was complaining about it. And he wasn't, which was interesting to me. And then I realized why. Even though he tried to glue on Magnitsky's name to this act, he's still saying, and you can find, if you Google it, you'll find like a dozen headlines that all say more or less the same thing. A Magnitsky-like act passed by the EU. So they're still managing to make it in the PR world seem like it's a Magnitsky-like act, which I don't even agree with that, by the way. But did you notice that?
Well, of course, they're still saying it because the purpose of it is the William Browder Protection Act. And if it's just a sanctions act on human rights issues, it's not a William Browder Protection Act. But he has so many friends in the media. He has corrupted the media. I suspect he probably paid off some of them. He has many millions of dollars that he stole. And so when you see the media, they are basically his acolytes. But what's interesting is he lost it. So first, that what's interesting about that is the law that was introduced by the Dutch foreign minister, Stef Blok. Well, apparently in 2018, and there's a tweet on this, Browder attacked this person, Stef Blok. He said, who was obviously at that point not favorable, being against the Magnitsky Act is often a career-ruining position. Minister Blok should study what happened to former Canadian Foreign Minister Stefan Dion for vociferously blocking Magnitsky in Canada. So he threatened him. Now, I'm wondering whether Minister Blok got back at him by putting in this law and lobbying very strongly. The Dutch lobbied very strongly not to get Magnitsky's name on it. But looking at the reality, so he gets a lot of stuff in his sycophantic media. So look at what's happened this month and last month. This is at just after the Swiss last month, the Swiss Justice Ministry. Last month, Attorney General indicated to Browder they will close the case based on his charges against a handful of his Russian targets, which he said were involved in the $230 million tax refund fraud from the Russian Treasury. By the way, evidence shows that Browder did it, and all of this is tried to deflect attention. But he had accused about a half a dozen Russians of getting money from this. There was no evidence. This, after 9 years, the Swiss are dropping this. So this is what's just happened, and he's trying to put a good face on it. But let's look at how we got this EU law. The first salvo by Browder was the Gross report that was adopted by the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. And it was line by line Browder's story. Gross even recanted about reference to Magnitsky being murdered, and that's on video. Then the U.S. federal court judge Pauly in New York in 2018 said it was biased. He refused to allow it as evidence in the Prevzon case. He said it was based just on Browder's statements, and it was not credible. But anyway, the parliament dutifully voted for a Magnitsky Act the next year, in 2014. But the European Parliament can only recommend. It has to go to the commissioners, to the commission which represent the governments, the foreign ministers. So that's when he threatened the Dutch minister, Stefan Blok. And there were resolutions in the European Parliament in March and April last year. They want a Magnitsky Act. They're naming 32 Russians that should be on it. But so this has become part of the EU has been doing these sanctions for the last two decades. They have over 40 different measures against individuals in 34 countries. This is how soft imperialism works. But once it was supposed to not be a law just targeting Russia, which, of course, was what Browder needed, what did he say? That people who don't want Magnitsky's name in the sanctions bill are appeasing the Kremlin. You know, that trope is getting very tiresome. It's really interesting to me. It didn't work this time. But then there's one, I think, a very important element, which has not been raised. Why, outside an international venue such as the International Criminal Court, one country or several has the right to try someone for crimes alleged in another country? So this would challenge and undermine the role of the ICC, the International Criminal Court. They'd seem not to talk about. Are they doing away with the International Criminal Court, which is an international body? And is this in conflict with that? Or is this going to weaponize human rights to target the international adversaries the way the Americans have? In which case, the targets will be only the enemies of the accusing countries. And this will be another imperialist, Western imperialist law. I am waiting for the U.S. and the U.K. to be charged for the persecution, detention, and abuse of Julian Assange. I'm waiting for the Americans to be charged for the tortures they committed, maybe who knows what they're still committing, in Abu Ghraib and in Guantanamo. Otherwise, this is another fake Western law, which has nothing to do with human rights, and it's only to do with politics. And the only good thing about it that we can take away is that Browder lost because Magnitsky name is not on it.
Well, let me take one semi-good thing about it, maybe, from looking at what I saw. So the Magnitsky Act that was passed in the U.S. in 2012, I'm going to say that this law looks slightly better than that, and I'll name two areas. One is, it's not obviously, when you read the text of the Magnitsky Act, it mentions protecting the American investors in Yugoslavia and Khodorkovsky. It's right in there, explicitly in the law. I don't see anything like that in there. But the other thing is, it seems slightly less arbitrary than the U.S. law, which it seems to me, unless there's some mechanism that I've never seen anybody talk about, if the Treasury Secretary and the Secretary of State decide Lucy Commissar is on that list, or Lee Stranahan's on that list, boom, we're on that list. But if we're foreigners, right? So if you're a foreigner and the Secretary of State, there's literally not a voting body. We don't know any way that they make the decision. It's just, boom, you're on it. It seems like this has like a little bit of like, and again, I'm not saying it's a lot better, but like some more of a system, some more of the actual rule of law. Am I being too Pollyanna-ish here?
I haven't read the bill yet, which just got passed yesterday. But I have read that they have some sections which seem a little closer to what a court might have, but I want to see what it actually says to what it, saying that, well, if you're on the list, you can get off it. Well, why should you be put on the list to begin with? It seems to me there needs to be a judicial process to put you on the list, and you could have evidence and you could have a lawyer and so on, not just that you can get off it. So I haven't seen it all. It may be a little better. The fact they didn't put Magnitsky's name on it is certainly a good thing. And maybe there are some people there in some of these European countries that not are not as Russophobic as the American administrations and the Congress have been. It's we have to wait and see who gets. They're going to have to now put people on the list. Who are they going to put on the list, and what evidence will they present? That's the first thing that we have to see, because otherwise the human rights law becomes an anti-human rights law. And anybody, any other country, suppose some country which the West considers a dictatorship says, okay, we want the same law and we're going to use it and we're going to target people and we're going to use the same lack of due process or due process that you have. What would they say about that? So I think we have to see how it plays out. The real issue is this new weapon that the West has developed, which is if we want to attack another country, we don't necessarily have to bomb them, although we can do that. We can send drones to kill their people. But another weapon is attacking individuals, because then we can say we're not attacking the country. We can attack individuals, and they can have, well, many of these people may not want visas anyway, but some of these people have bank accounts. Ironically, some of the there have been recently some attempts by some Russians to unfreeze bank accounts in places like Switzerland. And the irony is that the system of secret bank accounts in Switzerland and elsewhere, the offshore system, was invented by the West. And now they are using that. I mean, I guess if I was somebody who wanted to keep my money away from these targets, I would put it in Liechtenstein. Liechtenstein, the joke is that's where Swiss bankers go to put their money, because Liechtenstein is run by a very corrupt system. That the guy that was head of the Supreme Court in Liechtenstein, his name is, it's very funny. You know, Germans are very big about titles. His name is Herbert Batliner, and he apparently had two doctorates. He was called Dr. Batliner, and he was the head of the Supreme Court. He was very involved in offshore corruption, and he had a multi-million dollar, up to I think a half a billion dollar art collection, which he donated to a museum in Vienna. And he said, and it's quoted in an Austrian newspaper, you can never have too many Picassos. So I suspect that a lot of people are going to now put their money, first of all, not in dollars. They'll put it in euros, because the Americans can only go after the dollars, and they'll put it in someplace like Liechtenstein. But all of this is a game that is played out, and it's not a serious way of dealing with either, certainly not with human rights. Not if Julian Assange, I mean, Julian Assange to me is the poster child for the violation of human rights by the Americans. If that's not the first person that gets put on a list, this law is totally useless. And we know that's not going to happen. So it's as I said, it's only useful and interesting to see that it could be a takedown of Browder, and why did that happen? And we don't know that. We have, more has to happen.
And the whole thing is such a perversion of human rights. When Alexander McCorris was on, I said, I've just gotten to a point when I hear people talk about human rights, I reach for my wallet to make sure it's still in my back pocket, because I know the con is on. Hey, Lucy, I know you're working on other stuff that relates to this. Hopefully we'll have you back on real soon to talk about that as well. I wanted to get you on quickly to talk about this latest development in the Bill Browder saga. Lucy Commissar, you can find her great work, her groundbreaking work, over at the Commissar's Scoop, and it is always great to have her on the show. That's Lucy Commissar. Coming up, we got Tom Nichols joining us. I'm Lee Stranahan. This is The Backstory. Back, final segment of the day on The Backstory. By the way, if you like terrestrial radio, you can check us out in Washington, D.C., 105.5 FM AM 1390 in Kansas City, 102.9 FM and 104.7, and on the AM dial 1140 AM, the great KCXL there, and all over the damn internet. Do me a favor. If you like what we're putting down, make sure to tell your friends, tell your neighbors. There's a place to get a broader and deeper, both. We're both wide and deep, which sort of sounds wrong, but we are on a lot of the issues. We bring you actual people with differing views, and we treat them with the respect that they deserve, and we just let you figure out what you think after that. Joining us now, Tom Nichols is joining us. He is a author, writer. Hey, Tom, how you doing today?
Hi, Lee. It's good to be on the show again.
Well, it's great to have you. It's always great to have you on. And you have a very interesting story now, and tell people where they can find it, about, I did not know this, about a chapter in Revolutionary War history. And it actually, Rod was pointing this out to me, it's actually somewhat reminiscent of Joan of Arc.
It is, yes.
With a slightly less of a bummer ending.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
So tell, what is the story? Go ahead.
Well, her name was Deborah Sampson, and I first became aware of her when I went to an exhibit at the Museum of the American Revolution in downtown Philadelphia. And there was a display case with her name and an etching of her and her story behind the glass panel. And she was a woman who enlisted as a soldier in the American Revolution. She dressed as a man to enlist in Washington's Continental Army. She was born in Plimpton, Massachusetts, to a kind of a noteworthy family. They had a Pilgrim legacy there, and she was one of six children. At age five, her father left the family to marry another woman. At age 10, she became an indentured servant for a church deacon until she was 18. Then at 18, Washington was offering money to male soldiers to enlist in the Continental Army, and she was interested in making more money. It so happens that she had one of these long and narrow, androgynous-looking faces, and she was an excellent weaver at the time, but the weaving wasn't doing it for her. So she attempted to enlist the first time. I believe that the first time she did it, anybody who enlisted, they were awarded 20 pieces of silver. But she was caught by a snitch. Somebody in the town recognized her bent left forefinger or something that she had injured at a loom while weaving. It was kind of known throughout the town that she had this bent forefinger. So she snitched on her. And, of course, she had to give up the 20 pieces of silver. She was kind of scolded, but not punished too severely. I mean, women at that time, if they impersonated the opposite gender, they could be arrested or flogged, fined, or some were even paraded through town as harlots. But she managed to escape this fate. She continued to work as a weaver for a while. Looms were very expensive, so if you were poor, you had to go to a tavern and kind of use the loom that was in the tavern. It was so only the rich women were able to afford real looms. But when she was about 22, it occurred to her that she wanted to enlist again. She wanted to try it again. And she found a venue, and she found that this time when she signed up, she could make 60 pounds of silver. So this was a bigger, more attractive offer. And it offered a three-year contract. She was accepted, and she was mixed in with 40 recruits. They all walked to, like, West Point, which is about a distance of 150 miles from the town in Massachusetts. And at West Point, they were put through extreme maneuvers and military exercises that really tested the mettle of any man, not to mention a strong woman. She took the name Robert Shurtleff, S-H-U-R-T-L-E-F-F, and she actually became a member of the light infantry. It was an elite corps of warriors, much like the Navy SEALs. She was about 5'7", so she was taller than the average man at that time, which was about 5'5". And she had really good teeth. And one of the requirements of soldiers then was to have good teeth, because you had to hold a musket while ripping apart gunpowder packets with your mouth. So if you had half your teeth missing, you would not make a good soldier. So I think at about 1782, she led 30 men in a battle. She was shelled at Yorktown. She got a bullet from a musket into her thigh. She was afraid to go to a doctor because having a doctor remove it, it would be revealed that she was a woman, so she removed it herself. She kind of hid out among all these men by avoiding heavy drinking and carousing with her corps buddies. And she was always volunteering for single-person missions. That way she could be alone and undetected. What is really, really fascinating about this case, I think, and I'll get to the end of her story soon, is that a relative of hers, a guy by the name of Alex Myers, wrote a book about her. It's called Revolutionary. As a girl, and this is an even stranger story, he had heard his grandmother telling stories about Deborah Sampson. Well, I guess it helped inspire Alex, who was having problems with gender identity. He was born a female, but he later became a transgender male. So this kind of thing must run in the family.
Well, no, wait a second. Let me stop you one second there, Tom, because I had a couple questions. So you say, so first off, she was able to pass this, what you're saying was basically a test of physical strength and endurance and stuff like that, like you go through in the military. She got through that.
She got through it. And she got through it without any suspicion, as far as I was able to determine. And not only that, but she lived 3 long months in a tiny cabin in a snowy part of Massachusetts with 16 men in the winter, and she was still not detected. Now, if she was detected, then, you know, they all came to a private agreement. It's like what stays in Las Vegas stays in Las Vegas, or what happens in Vegas, you know. But in any event, there was no trouble with her 3 months in this tiny log cabin with 16 men in Massachusetts. And however, on a mission to kind of quell a mutiny, it was just outside of Philadelphia, she contracted some kind of a fever during an epidemic, and she had to have a physician look at her. Well, this physician opened her jacket and discovered the truth, but, I mean, apparently he was a cool and cosmopolitan physician. He didn't report her. He actually liked the person he had met, and instead of turning her over to the authorities, he just wrote a nice letter on her behalf and told her to carry it until the day that she was really apprehended, because the clock was ticking and she couldn't get away with this forever. And so the letter eventually helped her not be arrested and to get an honorable discharge from George Washington himself. Now, I mean, as far as I know, George Washington did not like any women in the camp, I mean, due to the impact that they had on discipline. And, you know, he also felt that they needed extra support, food and baggage and whatnot. So he instructed his generals to remove all women from service to improve discipline. And when he handed Deborah her honorable discharge in person and in writing, he really did not utter a word of thanks, but these were different times. You know, after the war, Deborah put aside her male identity and went on to marry a man named Benjamin Gannett. I think in 1795, she had three children. They lived in a small farm in Sharon, Massachusetts. And then she had an epiphany of sorts. She thought that she should apply for a military pension. Of course, Congress initially denied it. But then a very strange thing happened when Paul Revere became a champion of her cause. And it was through Paul Revere that she was finally able to obtain this long sought after pension. But the pension was only $4 a month. But she spent the remaining years of her life lecturing about her time in Washington's Continental Army.
That's a question I was going to actually ask you next, Tom, was how. So you're saying Paul Revere, like, at when did this become? I'll let you jump right back in the story. When did it become known that she had done this? When did people in the public, let's say, whatever news media there was at the time, when did people first start to figure this out?
That's a very, very good question. I wasn't able to find anything about how the news spread. My guess is that it was largely kept under wraps until she wanted to get a pension, and then she called more attention to it. And it was through these frustrated legal channels that somehow Paul Revere heard of it. And I'm not sure where she met Paul Revere or how Revere entered the picture, but he did become a true champion of hers, and she was able to finally get this pension through Revere. And what I didn't know was that just in 2019, Congress passed the Deborah Sampson Act, and it was improved the benefits and services provided by the Department of Veterans Affairs to women veterans and for other purposes. You know, but she was not the only woman who dressed as a man in the Continental Army. There were a few others. You know, there was one woman named Anna Maria Lane. In fact, she was the first documented woman to serve in the Continental Army. She fought alongside her husband, and she called herself John. She was awarded a pension for her part in the Battle of Germantown. And I don't know if she had great difficulty getting a pension, but apparently not. There was a woman in the Civil War by the name of Sarah Wakeman who enlisted as a Union soldier as Lyons Wakeman, and she served for 6 months. And yet there was another woman who served in the Continental Army. She was an Irish immigrant by the name of Jenny Hodgers. And she became Albert Cashier, and she enlisted in 1862. And after serving time, though, she continued to live as a man. So to her, this was much more than just donning a costume to help fight in the Revolutionary War.
That's interesting. It raises another question I have, which is how much of this was. So it sounds like in the first case you're talking about, maybe the motivation was financial, like she wanted to do something, and she just seems like she'd fallen on hard times and so on. How much of this was financial, and how much of it was political, and how much of it was personal in these cases? I know there are different cases you just mentioned, but was there an aspect that was either the last one? It sounds like it's personal. It sounds like a woman who identified as a man.
Yeah, definitely. I think in Deborah's case, she was filled with ambition, and I think she just wanted to make more money. She obviously believed in the cause, but you know, and she was known as a very good weaver. You know, she was extremely talented, but again, very poor, and she could not afford her own loom, so she had to work upstairs in these taverns, which was a pretty dicey environment for women weavers at the time. And, You know, and so I guess she was tired of earning so little for so much work, and she saw all these young men in Massachusetts who, at the time, though, the young men were not heeding Washington's call to enlist because they had already done their time in various local militias and whatnot. So they were, like, fed up about signing up again. So because few were signing up, despite this offer of 20 pounds of silver, Deborah sprang into action. And the first time that she signed up, she got a man's cap, and she put her hair behind the cap, and she made sure that her breasts were, like, hidden beneath a bulky top coat. And, you know, she adopted the name of Timothy, and she signed the service contract and received her silver and then went home and just, like, waited for the call to action. And that's when her plans were thwarted, when this snitch, this, like, friendly neighbor type, had noticed that bent forefinger from the default loom. And so her cover was blown. But she came back and she tried again, and she was successful. Like you, I think this is a true American Joan of Arc story without the terrible, fiery ending. So, you know, and I don't know why this isn't more well-known than it is, why one just finds it in, like, obscure places. And, I mean, I found it in this major museum in Philadelphia, which I must say I give a lot of credit to, because they were only one of two museums, the first ones to do a live press event after that first terrible lockdown. And so they had real writers there looking at exhibits with the real reception. So I credit the Museum of the American Revolution for being brave enough to break the mold.
Well, I would also say you should definitely get to work on the screenplay, because this sounds like a Netflix movie waiting to happen right now. And especially in our time, because it is an interesting story that would have what they call in the business. And of course, when I say the business, I mean the industry, a strong female lead, where you could get. Oh, I know who would be. I'll tell you. You get Ellen/Elliot Page, who's now using the name Elliot. Boom. This is, get this to her people, his people, whoever's people.
Right. Yeah. I'm not sure what her first name is, but that's a strange story. But I think you're right. I mean, this is very, very topical. People tend to think of these issues as purely contemporary, that if they existed in history, they were few and far between. But in fact, as they say, there is nothing new under the sun, that these things have been going on forever, and they'll continue to go on forever.
Yeah. Now, and by the way, I'm not even really joking. It's Elliot Page. It's hard for me to adjust when people change like that, and it takes a little bit of time. But this actually would be the perfect vehicle for her right now, because it would be the perfect vehicle for them right now, because they've got publicity, and this is an interesting and true story. And so I'm curious, in the last couple of minutes here, how did you come across this, Tom? Well, how did you find, you said it was in the museum, and then you just kept following it? How did you decide to write a piece about this? And again, tell people where they can find the piece.
Yes, well, I just went to this normal press event. It was the first live press event since the big COVID lockdown back in March and April. All the museums here were completely closed, or they were doing virtual Zoom things. But this museum had a real live thing with coffee and croissants afterwards. And I'm just moseying around the display cases, and I see this one display, and I start reading it, and I'm absolutely riveted at the story. And I'm asking myself, why haven't I heard this story before? Why would anyone keep such a fascinating story a secret? And when I went home, I did a Google search. And of course, I found out that it was not so secret. There are a lot of things that have been written about it. but apparently not enough because it still hasn't gone through the big cosmic horn where, like, everybody knows about her as they do about Benjamin Franklin or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I was just really fascinated, and I did more and more research, and I had to find out all about this woman.
Well, Tom, a great story. Thanks for sharing it with us. And we would love to have you back on again soon. And I want to thank all of our guests today, not just Tom Nichols, but also great Lucy Commissar. And, of course, Andrew Arthur from the Center for Immigration Studies. Another great show. Thanks to Rod. Thanks to Saul. And thanks to you for being part of the audience and our little family here on The Backstory.